Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 13th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. This week, we've got a great episode for you, but before we dive in, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because I rely on the listener support of people just like you. If you want to pledge your support, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy, or you can learn more at talknerdy.com. This week's top patron is Rob Schreck. Thank you so much, Rob, for your very, very generous support. Also at the top of the list, I want to thank Daniel Lang and Mary Neva. And I want to thank Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitus, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Chris. Thank you all so, so much. All right, let's dive into it. Super interesting chat for you guys today. I had the opportunity to sit down with, well, remotely, of course, with Dr. Walter E. Massey. Oh my gosh, I don't even know where to begin. Chairman of the Giant Magellan Telescope Project. He was the first African-American professor of physics at Brown University, the first African-American president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS, also the director of the Argonne National Laboratory, where there's a Walter E. Massey Fellowship established, first African-American chairman of the board of Bank of America. Oh, and he also ran the National Science Foundation. So yeah, what an astonishing career. And I mean, those are just the highlights. So, so much more. So I had the opportunity to sit down with him and talk about his new book, In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. But don't worry, we also talk about physics, we talk about leadership, we talk about race in America, and so, so much more. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Walter E. Massey. Walter, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And good morning to you, sir. Although I'm not sure where you are hailing from. It's morning here in Los Angeles. Where are you connected from?
We are actually on Cape Cod for the summer.
Oh, wow. Lovely.
It's 1 o'clock here. And it's a beautiful day.
Was there flooding? Was there any effect from the hurricane?
No. Well, we had two. We had Henri, which missed us completely, and we had Ida, and it wasn't so much the hurricane, but we had several tornado warnings. Mm. So we were up all night watching, because none of them landed, but they came right, the warnings were right in our neighborhood. So wow. it was pretty harrowing.
Yeah, but it sounds like you dodged a bullet for sure.
We did.
That's good to hear. And I can imagine I'm looking at your Wikipedia, what is this? Let me do my math really quickly. 83, is that right? 83 years?
My age?
Yeah.
Yes.
80, in your 83 years on this planet, you have probably seen and experienced quite a lot, both harrowing and, of course, humbling and exciting and very emotional. And I'm so excited to be able to spend some time with you and learn a little bit about your life and your story, especially for folks who don't know about Dr. Walter E. Massey. So maybe we start at the end and we work our way back.
So follow your guidance.
Yeah, so you have a new book out. It's called In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. And when I got this book across my desk, I remember thinking, well, this is not relevant to me or to Talk Nerdy. We're a science show. This doesn't make a lot of sense. And then I started to dig and I started to dig and I started to dig and I realized, what is a physicist doing chairing the largest financial institution in the country through a financial crisis? This is like the story just gets more interesting and it gets deeper and deeper. And so let's start at the end, work our way back to the beginning. How did you become the chairman of Bank of America?
I had been on the board of Bank of America for about 16 years in 2008. I had joined as a member of the Bank of America company in San Francisco before it merged with Nations Bank and became the new Bank of America. And another question might be, well, how did I get even on board?
Yeah.
And that's another story. But when I was director of Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago, which is one of the oldest and largest energy research labs and national labs in the country, is where Enrico Fermi first started when they discovered nuclear fission. And it's so when I was director of Argonne in Chicago, it was a very prominent position, even though I was a professor of physics at the University of Chicago. I was also director of Argonne. And it brought me to the attention of, I had corporate leaders in the city, because as director of this large facility, it was also a research facility, but it had a budget of about over $300 million and about 3,000 employees. So we were an economic force in the region also, an economic. And that's brought me to the attention of the corporate community with whom I had to work a lot on issues. And I was asked to join boards. And one of those was a bank called the First National Bank of Chicago. So that's where I first got banking experience. So throughout my career, I kept doing my science education administration, but I began to serve on boards. So in 2008, I was a member of the Bank of America board, and we had a combination leadership of chairman and CEO, the same person. That's quite common. In fact, that's the most, I guess, normal configuration of boards. One person is chairman and CEO. However, some companies have a separate executive chairman and CEO, and the chairman oversees the entire board, and the CEO reports to the chairman. So Bank of America, during this 2008 crisis, we bought Merrill Lynch. And I go into some detail in the book to tell the reader about the situation then and the fact that when we bought Merrill Lynch, it put us into deep financial trouble to the extent that our shareholders voted that the bank separate those positions of chairman and CEO. The board voted to do that. The shareholders voted to do that. Then the board elected a new chairman, and to my surprise, to my shock, they elected me.
Wow.
And I had no warning.
And were you ready?
I had given it no thought whatsoever. No, it was the furthest thing from my mind. There were other people on the board who I thought were, that when it came to a vote, I would support them, never thinking I would be the one to be asked to do it. And it was an honor, of course, chairman of Bank of America. That's, you know, that's quite something. And I was pleased and taken aback, but I thought, well, okay, I've been on boards a long time. And I had been on boards where there were separate CEO and chairman, Motorola, for instance, and McDonald's. So I had seen what a chairman did. And I thought, okay, I can do that. It's about 2 days a week, and you oversee the board, you set the agenda, you appoint committee chairs, you make sure things are moving well, you stay in touch with management, and the bank, you stay in touch with the Federal Reserve and regulators. And I'll have a lot to learn, but I can do that. And then, that was a Wednesday.
Oh,
the next day, Thursday, I got a call from the Federal Reserve, the agency which oversees large banks. And people have heard of the Federal Reserve, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
I got a call from the Federal Reserve in Washington telling me I should go to Richmond, Virginia the next day.
Okay.
And meet with the local Federal Reserve president in Richmond, which oversees the bank. And I would get a message that I should take back to the board. And that, as I point out in the book, that changed the equation. Because at that meeting, I was told there were a number of things that had to be corrected in the bank. And they were looking for me as the new chairman to make sure these things happen. So it became a full-time job.
Wow. And how, I mean, you had been serving on boards, as you mentioned, for quite some time. You had been doing a lot of philanthropy. You had really kind of diversified the work that you were doing, but you're trained, and we're going to, you know, obviously come to that. You're trained and had been, you know, historically a physicist for a very long time. Is there a lot of, I guess, translation that you can point to there, things that your experience as an academic really helped prepare you for in taking on, you know, this very fast and seemingly overwhelming task?
I've been asked that quite a bit in various forms, that question and the other, maybe even more precisely, is there anything about the physics, my physics training and experience and research that translates into leadership and other organizations and big organizations? And I think there is something, one of the things that I took away from physics and I still take away is a sense of confidence, first for me, that you can master a difficult subject. And you sort of learn how to learn and how to take on problems. Physics is wonderful. It's a lot of fun if you're into it. But it's not easy. It's a lot of mathematics. I major both in math and physics. And these are things that require you to make sort of a commitment to learning. And you have to have a kind of belief in yourself that you can do this. And I think once having done that through physics, I began to think generally when I was given the opportunity to take on new challenges or forced to take them on because I was put in difficult situations, I would be apprehensive, but I would think, well, okay, here's how you do it. And I would stop and think about it. So that's one thing I think I did take away from my physics career, a problem-solving capacity and the belief that one can solve difficult problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this all kind of started way back when you began your academic career at a historically Black college in Atlanta, which of course now you are a president emeritus of, and that's Morehouse College. You did your undergraduate degree there?
I did. I went to Morehouse College from Mississippi out of the 10th grade on a special Ford Foundation scholarship.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in the book, and maybe I should explain it, you read it to the listeners, it's about my time as chairman of Bank of America, but I flash back and recapture growing up in Mississippi, being president of Morehouse, doing science. So there's a thread, one might say, a through line about my experience that year at the bank, which I think is fascinating in itself. And for people who have some curiosity about that crisis 10 years ago, I hope it's explained in terms you can understand. But even more, I try to use that as a basis for writing a short version of my memoirs. I have written a much longer version of my memoirs, but my publisher and I thought it was just so long that it would be good to sort of write them in different volumes. So this is the first of what I hope would be other.
Kind of like an entree to the larger one.
Yeah, and hors d'oeuvre. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think sometimes even for younger listeners, such as, you know, myself, you were born in 1938. I was born in 1983. And so when I think about the civil rights era, it's something that happened before I existed. And so I reconstruct it based on documentary, based on interviews, based on what I understand about history. To me, it's history. You know, my mother was born in the 40s, and this is the history of my country. For you, this was your life. You graduated college in 1958. So that's a solid 10 years before
we lost MLK, before we lost Bobby, before this sort of, you know, what we think of as being the culmination of a very dark era. But you were living throughout the 40s and 50s in the face of Southern discrimination in Mississippi.
That's true. It's very interesting when I speak now to young people, and everyone mostly is young.
See, tends to happen, right?
I take it for granted that people know these things, and I have to stop too. Of course they don't. And you speak of the 50s and 60s. Well, I grew up in Mississippi in the early 40s, born in 1938. And it was way before the civil rights movement, even though there was NAACP local chapters doing things. But when I grew up, and I talk about this in the book, it was total apartheid, like segregation. I mean, total. You know, black, colored. We were not black. We were colored. Colored water fountains, white water fountains. You couldn't shop at certain stores. You couldn't eat. This was, of course, before any sit-ins, which happened in the early 60s. Totally segregated schools, movies. You had to go in the back, go up the outdoor fire escape to sit in the balcony, if you could go at all. So, you know, that was my childhood. And then I went to Morehouse when I was 16. I didn't finish college. I got this Ford Foundation scholarship to go out of the 10th grade. And at Morehouse, we began to see glimmers of the civil rights movement when I was a student, because that's when Martin Luther King Jr. was pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in the city. So, yeah, I lived through and continue to live through that entire early period, and then the movement in the 60s when things began to be much more public and much more engaged.
And so, you know, I want to talk soon about your academic life and about physics. Obviously, this as a science podcast, that's the focus of our show. But while we're on this very, I think, important topic, just because I'm so personally fascinated and equivalently concerned, I'm wondering, as a child growing up, as you mentioned, in the segregated South, in an apartheid state during Jim Crow, part of your understanding of reality was that there was a deep racial divide in our country. How aware were you as a child of racial violence? I mean, obviously, this is an era of lynchings. This is an era of terrible, overt racial violence. Did you were you protected by your parents or by your family from that? Was it a very overt and was there an awareness in children's minds?
It was not as overt in their minds as one might expect. First of all, this was a time when there was very little media. Though things might be happening 20 or 50 miles away, if the papers didn't cover it, and they didn't, because the papers were white, there was no social media. It was not even, we got our first television set when I was 10 years old. So you didn't get the news. That's one part of it. Secondly, I was protected by not just my parents, and I'm not sure the word protected is the word, embrace, nurture. I point out in the book that people are always surprised when I say, in spite of growing up in that era, I had a happy childhood. My mother was an elementary school teacher and principal, and my father worked at one of the few, only progressive companies in Hattiesburg, which I talk about, Hercules Powder Company. And we had a community. Went to all black schools, but the teachers were black. Say my mother was one of them. And so we didn't see everyday violence in our community growing up. We had the racial encounters, the racial slurs, the insults. The closest I came to real violence, seeing it, was, and I speak about this in the book, when the police, a couple of white police, killed our pet German Shepherd because my grandmother wouldn't sell it to them. And I was about five, and I came across the dog lying in its pile of garbage. And I would, you'd get insults like the bus drivers. You had to ride the back of the bus, and sometimes they wouldn't let you off at your stop. They would drive us, wouldn't let us off until we were in this neighborhood of whites who were, I hate to use those words, but they were kind of lower class whites. I put it as a derogatory term. I won't use it. And they would throw rocks at us and jeer us. Interesting enough, we were not afraid of those. We throw rocks back at them. Mm-hmm. They were not the power structure.
Right, right, yeah.
But we knew the real power structure.
Yeah.
So, and I had a good education. When I went to college out of the 10th grade, our teachers were black, but schools were totally segregated. I found out later just how inferior our facilities were. Later when schools became integrated, you could see what the white students had. But my parents, my cousins, my friends, we had a community. Now, I have questions whether or not I'm filtering this through my own memory, and perhaps I'm blocking out things, and my childhood was not, as I'm telling you, it was. But I went back to Hattiesburg, where I was born, this place I'm speaking of, a couple of times, and I was writing a book, spoke with my old friends, my closest friends, who I speak about in the book, and others, and they remember it the same way. So I feel validated by that.
Yeah. And so when you went on after you did your undergraduate degree at Morehouse, you were mentioning this realization or recognition of integrated schools. So when you went on to do your PhD at Washington University in St. Louis, is that one of the first times or places where you started to see the sort of deeper reality, because that was an integrated school?
It was, and it is. No, I began to see it earlier in Atlanta, I think, when I went to Atlanta and we visited, even up at Morehouse, we visited Georgia Tech, for example, and other, I don't know if I've gone to Emory, but other white campuses, and you begin to see then. It was mostly being in the city. And then visiting Detroit. I visited Detroit in the summers quite often because my biological father lived there. My mother and my biological father were divorced before I even remember. Maybe I was two. But she got pregnant when she was a sophomore in college with me. She and my biological father did not stay married long. She remarried, and the man who raised me, I call my father. But I spent summers with my biological father and stepmother in Detroit. And it was in Detroit that I began to see the real, I think, difference in what I had experienced in Hattiesburg.
Right. And also you spent quite a bit of time towards the end of your PhD and really started a new chapter in your life in Chicago.
That's true. After I received my PhD, my first job was at Argonne National Laboratory, but subsequently I became 11 years later, I became director of this lab that I was speaking about earlier. But I was a postdoc then, an interning position. And that's where I began to do my initial research. Argonne is located about 30 miles, 25 miles or so southwest of the city. It's operated by the University of Chicago under contract with the Department of Energy. And all of the national labs have that model. Some of the other labs people might have heard of, Los Alamos, which is the weapons lab, Livermore, where the nuclear hydrogen bomb was designed, and others. So Argonne was operated by the University of Chicago. So I opted to live in Chicago, as many of the scientists did, and commute out to the laboratory. And that's where I met my wife, Shirley, in Hyde Park. Only we connected, didn't actually meet in person, I think by phone, the day before Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And my birthday is April 5th, and he was assassinated April 4th, 1968.
I mean, I don't even really know how to ask this question, right? It's not so much about how significant was that. I mean, it's earth-shattering, it's paradigm-shifting. But how involved in the kind of civil rights movement, how important? Because I see as your academic career grew, so then did your advocacy. And so then did your work in, you know, you became the advisor to the Black Students Association, you became a chairman of the Black Faculty and Staff Association. Ultimately, you held positions within organizations that elevated and empowered Black physicists. You know, how would you sort of describe this lockstep movement of your development as a physicist and also your sort of racial awakening and your role in fighting back against racial discrimination?
I think Martin Luther King's assassination was a triggering point for me to become more engaged. As I said, I want to give the listeners some dates. I finished college in 1958. I went to Howard, actually, for 1 year in graduate school, but I didn't stay there. And long story, but I went to then Washington U, got my PhD in 66. I went to Argonne in this position. I was deeply involved in research. I wasn't even teaching. Argonne was a fully research laboratory, so I was doing physics. That's what I was doing. And my thinking then was, you know, when I got my PhD, there were maybe roughly 20 other Blacks in the entire country with the PhD in physics. We all knew each other. And I thought, well, here's my contribution here. You know, I'm going to, you know, be a role model to the physics, try to recruit others and help others become engaged in this field. But, you know, people have invested a lot in me to get me to this point. So I should try to be the best physicist I can be. You know, that should be my contribution, right? Because people are doing other things, so, and there are only about 20 of us, I should do this. So I was doing research, and then Martin Luther King went to Morehouse, of course. So it was much more personal. I hate to say it, it wasn't more personal to me than most of the people, but it resonated more because all of us at Morehouse grew up knowing about Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Benjamin Mays, who was president when I was there, was Martin Luther King's mentor. And he is the one who helped. So at Morehouse, you're just, Martin Luther King's embedded in your psyche, being kind of. And that his funeral, I was watching by myself in my apartment in Chicago. And Benjamin A. Mays, developed the eulogy, and the funeral was held on Morehouse College's campus. It was televised. So all of that was
home.
Just,
yeah, it's
right.
Home.
It was just so emotional for me. That's when I decided that I really wanted to be more engaged, that I didn't want to just do the free research. And it happened that I got an opportunity to go to the University of Illinois, Urbana. And I thought, well, yes, you should be, if you're on a college campus, there are going to be Black students. You know, there are ways you can engage more than just going to research. So that's what I did. I went to Urbana. And you said, how do you juxtapose all of these things with the physics? Well, it's one of those serendipitous events in my life, of which there have been many, fortunate for me. Urbana not only was a place where they were recruiting a number of Black students from inner cities, so there were a lot of them there for that time. They admitted 500 in 1 year. And Urbana, University of Illinois Urbana, had the best physics group in one of the best in the world in my field. So I had this opportunity to go and be with this fantastic group. Condensed matter theory is what I did. I'm a theoretical physicist looking at properties of materials at very low temperatures. like superconductors, superfluids, helium. So that's attracted me to Urbana. Well, I got involved. The first night I was on campus, before I'd even unpacked, I was sleeping on the floor because I didn't have a bed. On blankets I had, I got a call about 12:30, and he said, is this Professor Massey? And I said, well, who's going to know?
Who's
I'm
asking?
I'm a professor. I'd never been called professor.
Wow.
I said, oh, wow, yeah. I hadn't gone to class.
Yeah.
He said, this is David Addison, and I'm president of the Black Student Association, and they've arrested about 250 Black students.
What?
And we are looking for faculty, Black faculty in particular, to come help us get them out of jail. And that was my introduction.
Trial so, by fire. Wow. Yeah. So we're right there.
I became advisor to the Black Student Association. I became the founding chairman of the Black Faculty Staff Association. And I really got deeply engaged in, you know, issues on campus having to do with Black students.
And I hear, you know, I hear stories when I talk to my friends in the sciences, especially my Black and Latinx friends in the sciences, who there's a struggle. And I can imagine that it was even more amplified in this era where there were, like you mentioned, there were only 20 people but there's this struggle between, I want to advocate, I want to be involved, I want to be a role model, and I want my Blackness and my scientistness to stand firm as my fundamental identity. But at the same time, I don't want one to necessarily interfere with the other. I don't want to be tokenized in one role over the other. Like being a Black scientist, especially in an era, or a physicist, especially in an era when there were very few other Black physicists. Did you ever feel like early on, at least, a sense of resistance to like want to embody that role as a voice for Black students, as a voice for Black science? Or what did you always sort of feel in your heart of hearts that it's part of the job and it's actually something that you're sort of proud to lead and to fulfill?
Well, I think you've captured the feelings of a lot of us, even now. I speak with young Black physicists, you know, this desire to contribute to racial progress by being deeply engaged, but also the desire to do your, you know, be at the top of your profession, because after all, that's why most people went into it. One doesn't randomly, you know, fall into doing physics.
Right. Very high achieving.
Right,
yeah.
Wake up one morning and say, "Well, I think I'll be a high energy physicist." So you devoted a lot of work and time, and so you want to be the best for a number of reasons. One, you want to be the best because you like what you're doing. Hopefully you love it. And secondly, not being the best in the field is another way of, quote, letting down the race, right?
Yeah, right. So there's
too. I think you've captured it well. So that's, in fact, something similar led to a big change in my life and career. I got so involved at Urbana that I felt I was just putting out fires, that I didn't feel I was really making any deep contribution.
On the science side?
On the racial side.
Oh, on the racial side. Okay.
And
yeah.
Because I was dealing with student issues, students would come to me, the president, the administration would come to me whenever I was head of the Black Faculty Staff Association, advisor to the students.
Right,
so
you were the guy.
So whenever there's an issue, you're there. And there were only about 5 tenure-track Black faculty at the entire University of Illinois, Urbana, where they had maybe 2,000. It's in the book. I have the exact number. But they had a couple of thousand of them. So,
wow.
You know, you're it. Yeah. You're it. And I was not unique in that position, and still it happens. It's almost a trap for Black and other minority faculty. They get called up on all the time to be the point of contact, the reference point, the person you call upon to be engaged in racial issues, especially when you're on tenure. And then when it's time for a tenure decision, they haven't done enough work.
Right.
They haven't published that book, or they haven't written those papers, and all of that engagement with the students on those issues doesn't count. So it just doesn't. I used to warn young faculty, black faculty, about that. Don't let yourself get caught in that trap. You know, if you have to figure out some way to deal with. So anyway, I decided that I was not in my optimum mode of doing research, and I was not really making any deep contributions other than being the firefighter. And the thing that made me think about, well, what is it I can do that will combine both? And I was teaching an introductory course in physics. I was also taught graduate courses, but this is one for undergraduates. And I had a number of the students that the university had recruited from Chicago and Philadelphia, black students, and they were not prepared. They simply, now I had white students not prepared also, but they were more so as a group. And they simply had not had the adequate high school science. Had nothing to do with their intellect, you know, their possibilities. They hadn't been taught. The courses they'd had were not appropriate. And I got interested then in high school science education. And so I had an opportunity to go to Brown, and I talk about this in the book, because a colleague of mine from Urbana had gone to Brown. And he asked me to come visit, and I spoke with them about what I wanted to do. And that seemed to be a place where I could do both. So I helped found something called the Inner City Teachers of Science, ICTOS, to try to provide the kind of undergraduate education for people who wanted to be science teachers, and especially who were going to maybe teach in urban areas. So that was a way I felt I could make a long-term, more strategic difference. And it's something that I would enjoy doing, and I knew how to do. I know how to teach physics, but I could learn how to colleague in education, and together we began to put together this program. So that was that shift to get me on more engaged in doing things in academia with respect to empowering, nurturing, and educating black students and trying to improve the quality of science for blacks.
And ultimately, you know, this culminates in a leadership position, you know, moving from, as you mentioned, keeping your head down, doing the work as a physicist, but also as a professor, into, you know, being in a leadership position and a role model position that transcended sort of racial barriers at the time and ultimately encapsulated science and science achievement. Because by, you know, a decade later, within the next 8-9 years, you served as the president of the AAAS and then the director of the National Science Foundation, which I mean, tell me about the change or the development to be in those positions. Did it happen kind of slowly and surely so that by the time you had that responsibility, it just felt like the next logical step? Or was it like, holy, how did I get here?
My life has never been a series of next logical steps to me. They haven't. They've always been surprising, fortunate, I think, pleasant surprises. But going to Brown, as I said earlier, really did change the trajectory of my career, because once I began to put together this ICTOS program, I had to learn how to do administrative type things. I was director of this program. It was a multidisciplinary program. We had a major grant from the National Science Foundation. And it involved, I had to get faculty from chemistry, physics, engineering, education, bring all of these people together to try to help put together the program. But it wasn't just for physics, it was for science and history. And so I became kind of known around Brown's campus much more than I would have if I had just been a physics professor, you know, over there in the physics department. And also, I became aware that actually I was seemed to be pretty good at this bringing people together and getting people to focus around a common objective and being in that leadership position, and that people liked working with me in those situations. And this was kind of a surprise because I'd been a theoretical physicist. You do a lot of work alone.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And as a result of my becoming known around campus, I think it was a result of that, I was recruited to be dean of the college at Brown, which was a big position, big, overseeing the entire undergraduate curriculum, you know, at an Ivy League school. So that was a big surprise. But that was my first real administrative position, and I learned a lot there about leadership skills, management skills. And that's when I was offered the director of Argonne from being dean there. But the deanship position at Brown was the key point that made me think, maybe I just don't want to spend the rest of my life doing physics alone. Maybe this is the route. Also, I saw that, well, in this kind of these positions where you're leading institutions, you can have a big effect, much more and a more visible effect on issues that are important to you than you can just by doing research alone.
Right, because not only were you in these leadership positions that had a large sort of, you were choreographing in many ways education for large swaths of the population, but ultimately, in as you moved into leadership roles at the AAAS and at the National Science Foundation, you were also setting the stage for academic achievement for, you know, decades. Like, this is, I'm not sure if the listeners all, and I don't even know if I fully appreciate what exactly the AAAS and what exactly the National Science Foundation really do, but it is a lot. It's an awful lot for contributing to scientific achievement within our country.
I like the word choreograph. I'm going to use that if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
I will try to acknowledge you, and if I may forget on occasion. But
no worries.
I think that is, that's interesting. That's a good description, because you're not so much the actor. You're not the facility, the person doing it, but you are trying to bring resources, people, facilities and things together to accomplish this goal, like choreographing a dance or a play. So the AAAS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And it is the world's, but it's certainly the nation's largest multidisciplinary science association. It's a membership association. And practically everyone who's a scientist belongs to AAAS is engaged. But it also carries out a number of programs and activities. Many of their programs have to do with science education and science efforts for minorities. And so when I was president and then chairman of the board of AAAS, I was engaged in programs that dealt with science education, particular science for Blacks, and then you begin to get more and more Latinos getting into coming into science. And also, I got involved in international science activities, especially in Africa, in Black Africa. This was before South Africa, you know, had its Mandela, and it was still apartheid. So I was one of their founders of the African Academy of Sciences, and I'm still a fellow there to try to do the same thing for African communities that we were thinking about trying to do here for Blacks in America who are not in science. The National Science Foundation is a government agency, and it is the agency that funds practically all of the scientific and engineering research in universities throughout the nation. And to give you a scale, the budget of the NSF now is about, I think, about $6 billion. It was much smaller when I was there. But it is the most influential science agency in the non-medical sciences. People may have heard of the National Institutes of Health, which fund the biomedical sciences. The National Science Foundation funds the physical, mathematical, and engineering sciences. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of those organizations.
I mean, you were appointed, so again, to sort of contextualize the history, you were appointed as director of the NSF in 1990, which means that you were serving under President Bush, the first Bush, H.W. Bush. And I can imagine that that must have been an interesting position to be in. And I mean, I think, you know, by today's standards, we think of President Bush as a relatively progressive Republican president by today's standards. But at the time, you know, his racial track record was not amazing. Some of the things that his party stood for were not amazing. And I can imagine that it must be a strange feeling to work so closely with an administration that has not historically been, or that historically has been at odds with some of your own core values. You know, it's just an extra layer of, let's say, diplomacy that you have to manage.
Well, actually, you're right. For that era, he was a fairly progressive president.
Yeah,
especially for Republicans. Republicans were quite different.
They so were. I mean, he did come in after Reagan, yeah. So there is that, you know?
No, it's so different. It's so interesting now.
And yeah.
Maybe before we end, we can talk a little about where we are now.
And that, yeah, that is definitely the plan, because for somebody who has a wide view of history, I'm very much interested in your perspective there.
But when I went for the interview, I wasn't seeking this position.
Mm-hmm.
I had been engaged on a number of advisory groups, one called the President's Council on Science and Technology, President's Advisory Council on Science and Technology, PCAST. And I'd met the president and his science advisor. That's when I was director of Argonne and then vice president at the University of Chicago. But I was asked, would I allow the president to nominate me?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't appoint you. It's a Senate confirmed position. You're nominated. You have to be confirmed by the Senate. And it's a 6-year term. And the reason for that is sort of like the chair of the Federal Reserve. It's an attempt to keep it from being an overtly political position.
Right, right. So it extends the term of the president themselves.
Yeah. The president. Now, of course, president can always try to fire. Does can fire almost anyone.
Right.
But when I went for the interview with the head of the office, the White House Office of Personnel, he said, well, the National Science Foundation is not, quote, a political office, but I do need to ask, do you belong to a political party? I said, yes, I'm a Democrat. He said, well, you do realize that as a presidential appointee, you have to support the president's policy in your area, science and technology. And you have to defend the president when you go to testify on the Hill. You have to support and testify and support the policy. Can you do that? I said, well, I happen to agree with his policies on science, which I did. He was very supportive of science. He was very supportive of the NSF's program in science education.
Because in the time, science was not an overtly political.
It was not.
Right? Like, science was bipartisan. There were, of course, issues, embryonic stem cell research, or, you know, that had some third rail.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
Climate, we were doing, just starting a climate research. Climate change was not political.
No, you're right. This was just an era that, you know, science and education were core foundational goals of both parties.
Right. The Senate was controlled by Democrats. As was the House, I think so. The Senate was, the House was Republican. And the chair of, so the chairs of the committees that oversaw, that had oversight of the NSF that determined their budgets, the Senate Appropriations Committee, subcommittee, were chaired by a Democrat, Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland. We became friends. She was a Democrat. So all of the people I had to deal with, even though I was in a Republican administration, I got support from both sides of that. Right, science was not seen to be there as it is now.
Yeah, and I think maybe, you know, although there's so much we skipped over and there's so many things I wish we could spend time talking about, but of course that is also the point of, you know, the podcast being just a taste so that people will, of course, check out the book, In the Eye of the Storm. One of the things that, you know, we had sort of foreshadowed that we might want to finish on is the big change that we've been experiencing now. And I think it's easy for many of us, especially those of us who are young, who are sort of maybe grew up in the Clinton years, a touch of the Bush years, some of us early on, the Reagan era, which is a little bit of a special circumstance, but definitely during, and then who lived through Obama's presidency. And now we're living in this era where, you know, the Trump era is at the forefront of our minds still. We've got the global pandemic. We have, intense, overt racial divides in our country. And I think sometimes the perspective and the context is, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. It's not lost, but it might be a little bit confused in the sense that you hear narratives. You hear some people saying it's worse than it's ever been. You hear other people saying it never went away. It's always been this bad. And then you hear other people saying, you know, it's always been this bad. There was a time when it was overt, then it went back under the radar, and now it's overt again. And I'm just wondering, as somebody who's lived through so much of this in different pockets of the country too, you know, in big urban centers, but also in more rural parts of the country and, you know, in a very divided South, what has been your take on sort of where we're at as a nation in terms of our humanity, in terms of our progress, in terms of, I don't know, you know, like just our health and our strength?
It's very scary to me. Let me address the science part. So I think we made so much progress in science in terms of democratizing in many ways, many more women, for example, many more Blacks, Hispanics. However, we're not anywhere near where I thought we would be, you know, after all these years. And I think back to my time at Brown, and we had a very, very good representation of Blacks then. It's almost a golden era, if I look back. If we had just grown, you know, annually, nationally, in a sort of linear way, we'd be just so much further ahead. So I'm disappointed that that the scientific community has not been really more aggressive and proactive in creating opportunities, not just creating opportunities, but actually being proactive and bringing into our fields more Blacks in particular, but Latinos also. So that's the science. But we've come along. There are more than 20.
Yeah, that's for sure.
A lot more. And maybe that 20 is an order of magnitude. There weren't 50. I'm sure of that. So now on the racial side, I think it's much more complex then, oh, it's always been this bad. We just didn't know it. Never been this bad. Nothing has changed. Well, clearly a lot has changed. I mean, you and I having this conversation, right? A young black woman interviewing me and a black person. This wouldn't have happened. We had a black president, and people say, well, it didn't change anything. But whether it did or not, it happened. So things have changed. However, I don't recall, even over all these years, being as concerned about the racial strife that seems to be building up and the kind of overt, manifestations of racism that came out really during the Trump era.
Right, almost now, huge step backward.
Think it has been. Now, people might say, well, it was there and people thought that way, they just didn't say it. Well, I think that's significant. When people can't say things and they can't exhibit things, it makes a big difference on society as a whole. It's not insignificant that people say things publicly or online now, as opposed to not saying them and just feeling them. So whether that's true or not, maybe, I'm not sure people always felt that way. I think people can change. I believe more people who may have been, hadn't thought a lot, if they're white, and they thought, well, okay, I don't have any issues with the black people. I'm out here in Idaho or wherever. They have been incentivized now, in my feeling, to exhibit the worst instincts.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And that can have any psychologist or sociologist tell you that. So it's not that, well, they were always like that. I don't believe a lot of these people were always. I think with the right leadership, a lot of those people would have gone the other way, or maybe been convinced that they should exercise their better instincts. That's a famous phrase, the better parts of our nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels to me almost like there's this bimodal distribution now where you see that the progress is way more progressive, right? Like you have, like you were talking about the fact that you and I are having this conversation, the fact that you hear young white people talking about privilege and you see white people marching in BLM marches in numbers that you never expected. So the allyship and just the kind of cross-country progress is extreme on one hand, but then you're right, there's also the overt dog whistling and the emboldening and the room the space that was made to almost go back to an era where you could publicly spit at people, where you could use racial slurs, where you could, it's mind-boggling because I definitely never saw that growing up.
And it's not even a dog whistle anymore.
Right, you're right. It's loud whistle.
It's right,
yeah.
Loud,
yeah.
Explicit language. Right?
Yeah, you're right.
So I try to stay positive about it. Hopefully we will get through this. And the thing that makes me feel positive are young people of all races. And just seeing how they are reacting very differently to all of this. And I think that's the hope of our future. And I feel very positive about that.
Well, and that sort of, that takes me to the very last question, Walter, like that I would love to close out the hour with you on, which is, I ask all my guests the same two closing questions because they all come from different walks of life and they all come from different sort of scientific perspectives. But these are deeper. These are a little bit more humanitarian questions. And so, of course, with all of your insights and all of your experience, I am, I'm really just interested and excited to hear your take. And these are big picture questions. So I want you to tell us, the listeners, from your perspective, in whatever context feels relevant to you right now. So it could be very personal. It could be, you know, at the community or the country level. It could be global. Or, of course, as a physicist, this could be a cosmic perspective. Number one, I'm wondering, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing you're most concerned about, maybe even a little bit pessimistic, even could be cynical about. But then on the flip side of that, as you mentioned, your kind of hopefulness and your positivity, where are you finding your optimism? You mentioned young people, and that may be your answer to the question. But yeah, ultimately, what is it that keeps you hopeful?
I think we have covered it. The thing that keeps me up at night in a negative way, and it did, frankly, really affected me greatly when Trump was president. I mean, it affected me psychologically. It just did. I mean, this guy was just scary. I'm so glad that's changed. So I sleep a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I think about positively are young people. And I'm sitting here in our house at Cape Cod, which I write about, but looking at pictures of my grandchildren on the wall here. They're now 20 and 18, but these pictures go back to when they were 5, 6 and so forth. I see their friends and their colleagues. I see the kind of interactions that they have. And I also see young people on college campuses, which is what I like about academia. Every year, you're always around young people. The student body never ages. You do. You get new people.
It's true.
And I think it's young people, and they can be frustrating at times because they haven't lived through things, and there's a tendency to say, oh, of course, things that you know, it's like your people say, I had to walk 3 miles through snow to get to school.
Right. Yeah, no shoes.
Yeah. Right, no, right. So, you know, young people can be frustrating at times due to their lack of historical context. But on the other hand, that's a positive. They aren't burdened by some of the things that we are burdened by at my age. And they will make changes. And I think that keeps me hopeful. Just seeing what they're engaged in makes me think those changes are going to be better, for a better future.
Hmm. Well, everybody, the book is In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. Dr. Walter E. Massey, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. It was an honor. It was a privilege. I learned so much. And I really had a wonderful time chatting with you.
Well, I did too, Carol. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.